To hear Mr. Amram singing "What a Wonderful World."
Yeah, it was a very special part of the event, of the commemorative tribute to the life of Robert Knight, and we want to share that with you, but we can't because we're out of time. You're listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI. org. This has been Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. I'm Catherine Davis, in studio with
Paulette Spencer.
Okay, so we've had some technical issues, but we hope you've been able to truly appreciate and enjoy this evening's program. Stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. We actually have a minute before Hour of the Wolf. The reason we have a minute is, well, I might as well just go ahead and let it rock. Stay tuned. Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This is a pre-recorded program. I will actually also be on till 5. Lister is away. But you're going to hear some real Sturm und Drang this morning. There's nothing you can do about that thunder other than enjoy. Stay tuned. We've got Rajan Khanna, Michael Swanwick, and Ken Liu coming up.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. When you think about it, can we ever truly know a person? Oh, Jesus bleep. There goes Dan again, thinking he's being profound. Yeah, okay. It's a hackneyed thought, but that doesn't mean it isn't an issue. You can see a person every day, recognize him or her, but how much of that person do you really know? That's a question that's the engine behind a lot of movies. It's all over the place, actually. Hitchcock's Suspicion, Training Day, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, The Empire Strikes Back. You know, somewhere inside that black mask, there's got to be a good Darth Vader, right? Anyway, Korean director Jong Yol-baek makes his feature film debut by flipping the question on its ear in the romantic comedy The Beauty Inside. This is actually the elaboration of an American miniseries of short films that appeared on the web a couple of years ago, and the plot is essentially the same. A furniture designer, here named Woo Jin, falls in love and begins a courtship with a beautiful furniture store salesperson named Lee Soo. The wrinkle is that every day, Woo Jin awakens in a new body, with no control over age, sex, nationality, language, an odd variable in context, or attractiveness. So above and beyond the difficulties of follow-up dates, turns out there's only so much Red Bull one can drink before the body just says, I want to sleep. Once the relationship is underway, Isu, the girlfriend, faces the unusual dilemma of knowing the man inside, but never being sure whether she'll recognize the face that greets her with each new day. The film is very sweet, very clever. Director Baek's low-key approach is lovely and goes down very easy. But it also means that Woo Jin is portrayed as a very reserved, very reclusive character. Given his situation, that's not surprising, and I can understand the practical consideration for it as well. By my estimate, there are at least 24 actors playing the same person. The fewer distinctive tics the character has, the more successful the illusion will be that it is actually the same person. But that doesn't leave a whole lot of personality to hang on to, and the lack is felt. To Baek's credit, you still wind up caring for the guy, but while Isu sees the things that make Woo Jin Woo Jin, it's harder for us to know what it is in the man that makes her think he's worth all this trouble. There's another thing about Isu. The Beauty Inside is all about loving the person despite the externals. I mean, it's there in the title. But given the casting of the very pretty Hyo Joo Han as Isu, there is the suggestion that the philosophy is a decidedly one-way street. He could look like a 50-year-old bank manager one day, or a guy whose face got pushed in by a shovel the next, but damn is his girlfriend good-looking. By the way, the original series cast Mary Elizabeth Winstead in the role. So the same issue applies there. It certainly isn't that attractive people are incapable of love, or unattractive people will automatically seek out their own kind, or are undeserving of the love of the pretty, but it would have added some welcome complexity if Baek hadn't taken the path of least resistance in casting his female lead. Like I said, The Beauty Inside goes down easy, but maybe it would have benefited from being not quite that easy. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, so check out what you missed by going to mightymoviepodcast.com.
Okay, thank you, Dan. Again, this is a pre-recorded episode of Hour of the Wolf, and I do what I can to keep the noise level down, but there's a thunderstorm, and if we were at the BAI studios, you'd probably hear it anyway if it were at the same time. This is, however, nice one. This is about 4 in the afternoon. Hopefully by the time we're airing, that won't be quite so, well, Sturman Drang, as I said earlier. But we have quite a jam-packed program for you this morning. Last night, we had the kickoff of our 25th anniversary of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, right? I should say right here in this building, except I'm not here in this building. I'm there in that building at 388 Atlantic Avenue, okay? Same place as WBAI, which is the third floor, but at the ground floor Commons Cafe, Brooklyn Commons Cafe. And we had Rajan Khanna and Michael Swanwick. But before we get to that, a couple of announcements. Not only did we have a wonderful and great reading last night, which you're going to hear shortly, but this coming Wednesday, September 16th, at the KGB Bar, the Fantastic Fiction at KGB reading series, which is hosted by Ellen Datlow and Matt Kressel, will have Tom Monteleone and Lawrence C. Connolly. So that's this coming Wednesday, September 16th at 7 p.m., and the KGB Bar is located at 85 East 4th Street, just off the second floor on 2nd Avenue, or the other way around, just off 2nd Avenue on the second floor. One way or the other, do go. Admission is free. You'll have a good time. And speaking of Ellen Datlow, she will be our live guest next week on the program. And I have a full bio for her. And, well, it's worth reading, because you should know about Ellen Datlow if you don't already. Ellen Datlow has been editing science fiction, fantasy, and horror fiction for over 30 years as the fiction editor of Omni Magazine and editor of Event Horizon and Sci Fiction. She currently acquires short fiction for Tor.com. In addition, she's edited more than 60 science fiction, fantasy, and horror anthologies, including the annual The Best Horror of the Year, Lovecraft's Monsters, Fearful Symmetries, Nightmare Carnival, The Cutting Room, and The Doll Collection. Nothing cute, by the way, about those dolls. Forthcoming is The Monstress. She has won multiple World Fantasy Awards, Locus Awards, Hugo Awards, Stoker Awards, International Horror Guild Awards, Shirley Jackson Awards, and the 2012 Il Posto Nero Black Spot Award for Excellence as Best Foreign Editor. Datlow was named recipient of the 2007 Carl Edward Wagner Award given at the British Fantasy Convention for Outstanding Contribution to the Genre. She was honored with the Life Achievement Award by the Horror Writers Association in acknowledgement of superior achievement over an entire career, and honored with the World Fantasy Life Achievement Award at the 2014 World Fantasy Convention. She lives in New York and, well, as mentioned, co-hosts the monthly Fantastic Fiction reading series at the KGB Bar. More information can be found at datlow.com, that's datlow.com, and on Facebook and on Twitter as at Ellen Datlow. Okay, so, last night we began our 25th anniversary season of the NYRSF readings, NYRSF. I did a long, long intro. I am not going to replay that. There was a lot of byplay anyway. But what it comes down to is that we currently admission for that series is free, and it will remain so. But we push very, very hard for donations, because it all comes out of pocket. There are donations. Any shortfall, I have to pay for. So we're going to be doing a Kickstarter to avoid that. But we're going to do that at the end of the year, which makes for better gifting, and there's financial reasons for doing it and stuff like that there. So 25th season, Gordon Van Gelder, whose birthday was yesterday, September 8th. It's very depressing when I think about his birthday for a simple reason. He was born the same day Star Trek first went on the air. Okay? So I remember the day he was born. Okay. That's how it's getting. So anyhow, Gordon started the series, and it has been handed down through a series of 8 curators over the years, although I think I am... Elizabeth is now the longest reigning queen or royalty of England, and I'm the longest reigning curator, of the NIRSIF readings. And we started off with Rajan Khanna, who regular listeners will have heard on my program before, and then followed up with Michael Swanwick. But first, let's hear the beginning of last night's reading, and I'll introduce Rajan on recording, just as this is, although a different time. This time shifting gets weird. Speaking of Rajan Khanna, he is an author, blogger, reviewer, and narrator. His first novel, Falling Sky, a post-apocalyptic adventure with airships, was released in October 2014. A sequel, Rising Tide, is due out in October 2015. His short fiction has appeared in Lightspeed magazine, Beneath Ceaseless Skies, and several anthologies. His articles and reviews have appeared at Tor.com and LitReactor.com. Hi, Max. And his podcast narrations, for those who listen to the radio, Max Schmid of WBAI. And his podcast narrations can be heard at Podcastle, Escape Pod, Pseudopod, Beneath Ceaseless Skies, and the aforementioned Lightspeed magazine. Rajan lives in New York, where he's a member of the Altered Fluid writing group. His personal website is at rajankhanna.com, and he tweets as Rajan YK. Please get rid of me and welcome Rajan Khanna.
Hi, everybody. Thank you all for coming, and thanks, Jim, for having me back. I was here a little less than 2 years ago. That was a year before the first book came out, so it was like, yeah, I'd made the deal. I knew it was coming, but it was a year away. So it's nice to be back a month before the second book comes out, which is, this is the arc, so that's the cover of Rising Tide. I have a beer here, just in case my throat gets dry. Which beer figures into the first book, if anyone's read it, so it's kind of apt. And I would like to say that the other half IPA that they have on tap here is pretty good, and if you like beer. So So the first book came out, and this is the second book I'm going to be reading from, and there's some spoilers that might come into play, and I'm sure most of you haven't read the first book. So I decided to read a bit from a flashback chapter, so hopefully there won't be too much in there that will get spoiled. But I'm just going to give you a little bit of background. This takes place in the future, in a post-apocalypse, after a disease has affected most of the population, a really infectious disease that you can get from fluids, and it turns people into ravening animal-like creatures. They're still alive, but they are hungry and violent and awful. So Ben is our main character, and what else do you need to know? So he's an airship captain. He has a partner called Claudia, who at the time of the flashback are romantically involved. And I think that's all you need to know. If anything else comes up, I will fill it in as I go. So here we go. It happened back a short while after my father faded. Oh, faded means turned into one of those creatures, sorry. It happened back a short while after my father faded, when I was still flying around with Claudia. This was back before she got the Valkyrie, when the two of us were living on the Cherub. The Cherub is a ship. I had been telling Claudia that we could get by with foraging, but she wanted to do other things, take on jobs, try for the big score. I eventually agreed. I think we were both reeling from what happened to Dad, and were trying to strike out into new territory. And I can't speak for her, but I was definitely feeling a little self-destructive at the time. So we spent more time around people. There was no gas town back then, but there were other settlements, either fixed or roaming. It's hard to keep track of people in the sick, but there are ways. When you move on, leave a message behind you about where you're headed, and a radio frequency. If someone is looking, all they have to do is go to that location and scan for signals. Of course, you have to do it in code so not anyone can find you. So we kicked around Zep dives until we found what we were looking for. the ultimate score. A police storage facility, Cheyenne said. She wore a cowboy hat and always seemed peppy. The smile on her sun-freckled face was as wide as the sky. We sat on a rooftop in San Francisco, our airships anchored around us, five folding chairs arranged in a rough circle. Forget it, I said. Everyone looked at me. Too much trouble. I've hit police installations before. Getting past security is tricky enough, and it's almost certainly crawling with ferals. Ferals are the creatures. Not to mention that it's probably been looted before, or maybe someone's living there. A lot of police facilities had shelters in them. That made them attractive to anyone looking to hole up, not to mention the weapons and ammunition they usually held. Don't worry about security, Cheyenne said and winked at me. She actually winked. I looked at Claudia, who shrugged. We knew Cheyenne the least out of everyone involved with this job, but of course she's the one who came with the details. No, seriously, Cheyenne continued. That's what Malik is for. All eyes turned toward Malik, standing quietly behind his chair. His hair was shorter then, and he favored a mustache over a full beard, but he otherwise looked much the same. He seemed preternaturally calm, unruffled. Out of everyone involved in the job, I had known Mal the longest, excluding Claudia. We were about the same age, ran in similar circles. Mal was a forager too, though he often trod the fine line between foraging and pirating. Oddly enough, he had a good reputation. He didn't kill or attack the vulnerable. And he seemed more interested in forming a group, getting like-minded people to work together. He had asked me to join up several times, but I couldn't really see myself doing that. We had worked on opposite sides in the past, but also together. I shouldn't have liked him, but the thing is, I really did. We had a kind of friendly rivalry. Benjamin is quite familiar with my ability to crack locks, he said. He directed a smug smile at me. Surely you remember Portland or Reno. Both places where he'd scooped me. To the others, he said, his smile never wavering, I am quite practiced in cracking old locks. Often the cargo I liberate is locked or secured, and it's worth far more in pristine condition. And I've been in military installations before. Already, that had become part of Mal's reputation. It kept him and his entourage well armed and well stocked. It also meant he was a good addition to this job. Do we know this place hasn't been hit before? I asked. That's just it, Cheyenne said. It's not on a base or a station. It's not an obvious target. Where then? Claudia asked. Cheyenne tipped her cowboy hat back from her head. A warehouse. A big storage facility. She leaned in. It's military-grade equipment, sold to the police. The way I hear it, the police were like small armies back in the clean. They had too much to keep in their station. There's plenty of stories about that kind of thing, Tess said, leaning back in her chair. A lot of that kind of equipment saw use when the bug hit. Tess had been making a name for herself at the time, already as an expert in the clean. She was older than all of us, short and square and smart. She looked at us from behind large, thick glasses. It's quality equipment, Cheyenne said, but the scuttle is that they never got a chance to use it, because of where it was. And how exactly did you find out about this cache? I asked. I looked at Tess, who shook her head, indicating it wasn't her. What's it matter how I found out? Cheyenne asked. Because if some cracked-out drunk told you about it, I want to know, I said. If some plod sold it for a ride in your ship, I want to know. It matters. Cheyenne held up her hands. Okay, okay. I did a favor for a guy I know, a fixer, and he was going to patch up my ship. Only the favor was a fuck lot more dangerous than either of us expected. The ship didn't need no more work, and so he offered something else. This location. How'd he get it? Claudia asked. His father, Reed. He'd been trying to get people together to go after it, but he doesn't fly in the right circles. So he gave it to me. Just like that, I said. Well, he wants me to bring him back something. A taste of sweet barter. But that's it. And you swallow this? I asked Tess. She nodded. I did some preliminary checking, and it seems to be legit, as far as these things go. It wouldn't exactly have been common knowledge back then. Everyone was silent as we mulled the whole thing over. So what's the plan? Claudia asked at last. Cheyenne smiled. We use only one ship. That way we don't attract too much attention. Ben, yours should do. She's fast, Claudia says, and you have the cargo space we need to get anything we want off of the ground. Okay, I said. Malik and Lord Tess help us get in, dealing with any physical or electronic security. The rest of us are muscle. We clear out any ferals in the way. Then all of us grab what we can carry, bring it back to the ship, and get the fuck out of there. Even split, I asked. Cheyenne nodded. Fairest way possible. I looked at Claudia. It sounded fine, especially with the five of us, but what it ultimately came down to was a matter of trust. I trusted Claudia, of course, and probably Mal. Or maybe not trust, but respect. I knew that I could depend on him and his abilities. I'd heard of Lord Tess. She had a reputation even back then, and she seemed on the straight, but I didn't know Cheyenne from a patch of cloud. What do you think? I asked. Claudia narrowed her eyes. I think that if this bears out, that it could keep us flush for some time. And I think that with this kind of score, I might just be able to get my own ship. I gritted my teeth at that. She had been talking about getting her own ship for weeks now. I wanted her to stay on the Cherub with me. Sure, we sometimes came close to killing one another, and I often found myself wanting to be by myself. But back then, I never had been. I had always been with my father. I think the thought of being truly alone scared me to death. What do you say? Cheyenne asked. With a sinking sensation in my stomach, I stared her in the eyes and said, "We're in." When you're an independent airship operator, your ship is your home. It's often your livelihood. It's usually one of the most, if not the most, important objects in your life. So leaving one behind always makes you apprehensive. For the job at the police warehouse, I was going to be flying the Cherub, but that meant that everyone else had to leave their ships behind. Using a single ship had been a good plan, of course. People in the sick are opportunists. See a few ships together, especially down on the ground, and you have an indication that something is up, something potentially lucrative. Lone ships are often not worth the trouble, unless, that is, you're desperate. And of course, one ship means less resistance than three, but on this trip, the plan was not to be noticed. I stood by the Cherub as the others approached. Mal eyed the ship appraisingly. Still no weapons, he asked. Mal had outfitted his ship, called A Star Without a Name, with several weapons he had liberated from military installations. I shook my head. Not my style. People change, Benjamin, he said with a smile. There's no need for weapons on this job, is there? I asked. She's fast, and she can carry. That's all that matters. He tilted his head. What's her name? Tess asked. The Cherub. Cheyenne laughed. What the fuck kind of name is that? She asked. It's named after a type of angel, I said. A smiling, plump baby angel, if I'm not wrong, Lord Tess said. I sighed. The cherubim were guardians and divine messengers, winged and terrible. Cherubs guarded the Garden of Eden in the Holy Scripture. They were said to have four wings, like the fins of the ship. Stupid name, Cheyenne muttered. I came very close to throwing them all off the ship. I had been used to having Claudia and my father aboard the Cherub, but having four other people made the gondola feel cramped. Even though I was at her controls, I could feel the other people around, behind me, in my air, my space. The Cherub's gondola isn't small, but it felt like it had been invaded. Something's been bothering me, I said. You're saying that this wasn't the first place the police came when the bug hit? You'd think they'd load for bear. Cheyenne came around to face me. They didn't have a chance, so I'm told. They were overrun pretty quickly. And that's all we have to go on? I did the due diligence, Tess said, dropping her weird phrases like she always does. Records seem to indicate that this area was overrun pretty quickly. Other places around the country make good use of their military-grade weapons, but at this location they didn't get a chance to. All those weapons, I thought, and in the end, they did no good. I don't like ferals at the best of times, but at least we know what they are, and to some degree how they operate. Back in the clean, when everything was just starting to go down, they must have been scared out of their minds. Friends, loved ones, comrades in arms, all of a sudden turning into something monstrous and violent, and most of all, hungry. At least when Dad faded, I knew what I was dealing with. I had been trained in how to handle myself, in how to handle ferals. They had no idea, but they soon found out. All right, people, Cheyenne said, ante up. I groaned. Really? She gave me a chastising look. It's tradition. Which was true. Zep crews would often select personal items or something from their last haul and put it in a communal pool. The person who performed best during the run, determined by communal vote, would get to take it. Dad and I never did that, even with Claudia. We felt that something earned was yours to keep. Didn't make much sense to add gambling to the mix. But on other crews, I suppose, it made a kind of sense. It was incentive to go above and beyond. But I often wondered if it didn't also foster resentment. I wouldn't be surprised if more than a few aunties led to murder in the dark. What's the win condition? Claudia asked. Kills and fills, Cheyenne said, meaning the person with the most kills, assuming there were any, and the most haul. Fine, I said. I grabbed an old plastic box and shook out the dust, three plastic pens, and an old razor blade. Then I slapped the box down in front of them. Cheyenne dropped in a knife. Nothing you'd want to fight with, but good for utility work, stripping wires, things like that. Tess dropped in a book, of course, but I didn't look at the title. I was too busy trying to figure out what to put in. You couldn't half-ass it, put in something like the pens I had just discarded. But I wasn't putting in something valuable. The idea of this trip was to come away with extra, not less. Mal, who hadn't really said much or reacted in any way when it was announced, simply reached for a ring on one of his fingers, of which there were several. Rings, but also fingers, and pulled one loose. It was silver and wide, with a large green stone in the center. It was, strictly speaking, ornamental, but metal could always be melted down. I decided not to give him shit for it. Claudia went next, dropping in a flare, useful and rare enough to be of value. I wouldn't have done it, but I knew for a fact that she had several more. Which left me. I was on the cherub, which meant I had access to all of my things. The question was, which thing? It came to me a moment later. A bottle of wine. I had found a few with Claudia a few weeks earlier. I could put one in and save the rest. The winner could either drink it or sell it. Either way, it was a good score. I grabbed one, a Merlot, and put it in the bin. Good, Cheyenne said. We're all set. Let's get moving. Man, if you would be so good as to take your fat baby up into the air? I gritted my teeth and moved to the controls. As I passed Claudia, I said, I am rethinking this whole thing. She patted my shoulder. It's a little late for that, honey. Yeah. The police facility was in what used to be Arizona. I'd only been through the area a few times, but it was striking how the land changed. The mountains here were knobby and red, a far cry from the steep, knife-edged, snow-covered mountains I was used to in the Rockies. The colors of everything seemed to change. There was more desert here, too. That was a good thing when it came to ferals. They weren't really equipped to be out in the desert. Dehydration would still kill a feral dead like it would anyone. But we were headed to the city, and there were bound to be pockets there. One of the great things about the Cherub, what distinguished her from a lot of other ships, apart from her name, which was excellent, was that she was equipped with VTOL engines. That meant that unlike a lot of other airships, which had to either stay in the air or needed complicated launch procedures, she could descend right to the ground for easy loading and then rise back up again. Easy peasy. Well, not so easy. It was hell to maintain those engines, and thankfully my father had taught me how to do a decent job. But for a long time, the Cherub was all I had, and I took good care of her. The VTOL was what made the Cherub a great choice for this job. If you're loading lots of guns and heavy gear, you want to be able to walk, or roll, even better, the stuff right up the ramp. Sorry, I'm skipping a bit. Okay. Where do I put down? I asked. Cheyenne walked over to me and pointed out the gondola's window. That's a beauty. Just across the street, there's a field. I looked where she pointed, and she was right. A football field. I had no idea how the sport had been played, but I'd seen pictures, and something about the way they suited up had intrigued me. The field was mostly clear and large enough to set the Cherub down. Of course, there was still a lot of ground between the field and the police facility. Cheyenne looked at all of us, as if reading our minds. It'll be fine. We land on the field, cover each other in the facility. It's mostly open, good lines of sight. After we get the gear, we look for something with wheels to help. If that crashes, we take as much as we can carry. That should be worth enough, but... But, I asked. She looked at Tess. The manifest I have says they have armored vehicles inside. If they're vintage and nothing's broken, well, we'll have our way out, won't we? I shook my head. I brought the Cherub directly over the football field. Okay, everybody load up and get ready. There was a sound of weapons being checked. I pulled out my father's revolver, popped out the chamber, and made sure it was fully loaded. I also had a backup automatic on my hip. Claudia tested her bow and inspected her arrows. "Someone will have to cover Lord Tess," Cheyenne said. "What?" I asked. "I don't carry," Lord Tess said. "What the fuck?" I asked. "And you think now is the best time to tell us?" "It's okay," Claudia said. She gave me a look as if to say, "Just go with it. I'll cover her. Just move when I tell you to, okay?" "Okay," Tess said. "Okay," Claudia said to me. "Okay," I repeated. I set the cherub down. The howls of ferals were already echoing across the open space as we descended the cherub's ramp. I held the revolver in my hand, scanning for any signs of movement. Beside me, Claudia fitted an arrow to her bow. It made me want to grab her and kiss her, but now was definitely not the time. Luckily for us, the field was made out of synthetic grass. I'd seen it before. Unnerving that they had such things, but it meant the field wasn't overgrown. Easy place to land, no chance of getting caught up or tripped. I set myself, the revolver out, and then they were there, barreling across the open space. I tracked my target, a tall, rangy, feral male, its long, thin limbs propelling it toward me with worrying speed. I sighted down the barrel, squeezed the trigger. The feral still came. I inhaled, sighted, and shot again. The bullet took it in the shoulder as it was coming up from its crouch, spun it around, and threw it backward. I swiveled to another target. Part of me was calmed by the presence of the others. It wasn't that I trusted them, except for Claudia, but they were experienced, except for Tess, and they were covering the places I couldn't cover, and for the moment that was enough. I didn't have to look behind me. I suppressed the urge to look behind me. I shot, then shot again, then again and again. The others covered me as I reloaded. The gunshots echoed across the expanse of the football field. Any ferals in the area would know we were here. That moment of alarm turned to delight as I watched feral after feral fall. They should know we were here, should know that we carried thunder, should know that they were coming to their deaths. The moment of triumph swelled and then collapsed. Cheyenne, pulling back to reload, slipped on the wet turf and went down on one knee. Mal was also reloading, and suddenly a hole opened up. Ferals are stupid, but not so stupid that they can't sense weakness, and a few of them curved around to come in on that side. And just like that, our order fell to chaos. I just had enough time to swerve the revolver around at the dark-skinned female feral who was springing toward me. The shot clipped it and stopped it for a moment, but it wasn't down. Then there was another, then another. "Fuck!" I heard behind me, but it wasn't Claudia's voice. I shot down a young feral male, dancing away from where it crawled at me. Then another two shots to take the female down for good. Then I was dry. I turned my head for a split second to see what was happening beside me. Scared, anxious faces, lots of bullets and arrows in the air. Then it was on me. For a moment, my brain couldn't make sense of things. This person had clothes on, a leather jacket, the tatters of a scarf. But survival instincts kicked in shortly afterwards. I slammed the empty revolver into the side of its head and threw it to one side. Recently faded, and no time to reload. I did something that I don't normally do. I moved toward it, kicking out with my boot, trying to get some space. I was closer than I ever liked to be, and not armed, and I wanted this thing away. I kicked again, but it dodged my foot, and then I was tipping backward. I hit the ground with my side, and I saw the thing pressing back on its legs, about to jump, and a bullet took it in the head. On an angle so that the spray went wide of where I lay. I looked back quickly to see Mal pointing his gun in my direction. I took the moment to slap a few bullets into the revolver, then turned and fired at whatever ferals I could find. It was loud and messy, and then it was over. Bodies littered the ground. My breath was loud behind my scarf. I counted five of us, all standing. Of course, the bulk of my concern was for Claudia. She was breathing hard, but seemed uninjured. For a moment, we just stood there, catching our breath. Then it was back to reality. Our rational brains quickly took over. I nodded to Claudia, then began checking her for any wounds or blood spray. She did the same to me. She gave me the all clear a moment before I did the same for her. Then I turned and saw Cheyenne, or rather, Tess and Mal looking at Cheyenne. "What?" I asked. "She has blood on her gloves," Tess said. "One got too close," Cheyenne said. "I had to hit it to get it to back off." "Are the gloves intact?" I asked. Cheyenne held her gloves out, and I could see the dark stain on them. "Get them off!" She peeled one back with one glove, then gingerly pulled off the other one with a handkerchief she pulled from her pocket, letting it drop on the ground as if it burned her. I moved closer, examining her hands. She held them out, flipped them over. I didn't see any blood, but I didn't touch her. That was always the hardest part. I might have checked her hands, checked for broken skin, cracked nail beds, anywhere the bug might have snuck its way in. Just because I didn't see blood didn't mean a microscopic drop didn't get through. But getting close, running my hands, gloved as they were, over her might just bring me one step closer to fading myself. It was safer to just keep an eye on her, prep to put a bullet in her at the first sign of strange behavior. But right then, there might have been a bomb in our midst, just waiting to go off. I'm clean, Cheyenne said, almost as if convincing herself. I'm clean. I looked at Claudia, who just raised her eyebrows. I knew what she was thinking. This was getting better all the time. Let's move, she said at last. She led us around the corpses of the ferals, then onto the building ahead of us. Claudia noticed the look on my face and touched my shoulder. It'll be fine, she said. We'll be in and out before anyone has a chance to fade. I nodded. That's what I was trying to focus on. Get into the facility, grab the gear, get back to the cherub, and put down Cheyenne. On the ground, I mean, as soon as possible. Otherwise, we'd be putting her down in another way. I think I'll end there. Thank you.
And you have been listening to a reading from the New York Review of Science Fiction reading series, recorded September 8th, just a couple of days ago, at 388 Atlantic Avenue at the Brooklyn Commons Cafe. The second half was the illustrious Michael Swanwick, and we will now hear his reading. Michael Swanwick has received the Hugo, Nebula, Theodore Sturgeon, and World Fantasy Awards for his work Stations of the Tide, which was also nominated with the Nebula Award, and was also nominated for the Hugo and Arthur C. Clarke Awards. The Edge of the World was awarded the Theodore Sturgeon Memorial Award in 1989 and nominated for both the Hugo and World Fantasy Award. Radio Waves received the World Fantasy Award in 1996. The Very Pulse of the Machine received the Hugo Award in 1999, as did Scherzo with Tyrannosaur, one of my favorites. In 2000, his stories have appeared in Omni, Penthouse, Amazing, Asimov's, High Times, New Dimensions, Starlight, Universe, Full Spectrum, Tri-Quarterly, and elsewhere. Many have been reprinted in many Best of the Year anthologies, and his works have been translated for the Japanese, Dutch, German, Italian, Portuguese, Spanish, Swedish, French, and Croatian publications.
And Chinese,
which brings us to Chasing the Phoenix, just out from Tor Books, which continues the adventures of Dargar and Surplus as they keep going further ever eastward. And this time, well, the title helps you. Chasing the Phoenix Through China. Other books include, yeah, we haven't even gotten to those. In the Drift, which was an A special, Vacuum Flowers, Griffin's Egg, Stations of the Tide, The Iron Dragon's Daughter, which is the New York Times notable best. Why in here are we not listing The Dragons of Babel? I don't know, but I hereby say it, even though it's not in my script. And Jack Faust. His short fiction has been collected in Gravity's Angels, A Geography of Unknown Lands, Moondogs, Tales of Old Earth, and a collection of short shorts, Cigar Box Faust, and other miniature. He lives in Philadelphia with the lovely Marianne Porter and their son, Sean. Please, everybody, welcome Michael Swanwick.
Thank you, Jim. You left out Klingon. As a technical note, when I take a sip of the water, that means there's a double space line break. I'm going to be reading from Chasing the Phoenix, which is my second Dahlgren and Surplus novel. Dahlgren and Surplus are post-utopian con men. Dahlgren is a nondescript, faceless man. To sort that if you look away from him, you lose him in a crowd instantly. And Surplus is a genetically modified dog. He stands on 2 feet. He has full human height and intelligence, but he is visibly a dog. That features into the adventures. In the very first adventure story called The Dog Said Bow Wow, they accidentally set fire to London. And as they were leaving by boat rather quickly, Surplus looked back and said, I can't help feeling in part responsible for this. And Dahlgren said, London has burned down before, and London will burn down again. We're off to have a great adventure in Khan, the Duke of Muscovy. So off they went to Russia, where they set fire to Moscow. In this novel, they accidentally conquer China. They don't mean to do these things, but these things happen to them. And I will not say what becomes of Beijing. Since, as I said, I read the first chapter of this 2 years ago, I'm reading, this is basically about there's a condensed version of the fourth chapter. And so far in the novel, they have arrived in China. Dahlgren is dead, but Surplus manages to bring him back to life. Surplus has passed himself off as a god, and they have resurrected a virtuous woman's career. So this is all these events have brought them to the attention of the local king. Oh, and I should say a word about the names. I took all the place names and translated them into English. So Xi'an is peace, for example. Chengdu, I called brocade, because that's one of its sobriquets. It's been known as Brocade City for the last 1,500 years for the quality of the cloth. And I gave all the Chinese names in translation. These are not contemporary Chinese names, but names as they will be after the fall of Utopia, when this is all set. Dahlgren and Surplus were brought before the Hidden King in a conference room where he conferred with his advisors. Who are these men? Asked the king. These are the low-born scoundrels who present themselves as figures out of ancient myth and superstition, White Squall said. If your majesty wishes, I can have their throats cut now and spare you the tedium of their pleas for mercy. With your permission, Chief Archaeological Officer White Squall, and yours as well, Chief Executive Officer Powerful Locomotive, it pleases me to hear what they have to say. Dahlgren nodded slightly, as if acknowledging something that was entirely his due. Then, stepping forward, he spoke. My name is Aubrey Dahlgren. And since my associate's name is not easily translatable into your language, you may think of him as the noble dog warrior. We were born, or rather created, in a laboratory in a faraway land in the final years of the Utopian era, when all the world was unimaginably rich. Not long before the fall of Utopia, the secret of perpetual life was discovered. To test it, immortals were created. Our genomes are so designed as to render us unaging and immune to all natural causes of death, though we remain as vulnerable to acts of chance and violence as any other men. There were 8 of us in the pilot program, but it has been many centuries since we've seen any of the others, and I must presume that they are dead. Each of our kind varied greatly from the others, for the goal of the pilot program was not merely long lives, but socially productive ones. Thus, my friend's character was so composed as to be decisive and active, making him a fearless fighter and protector of the weak. I, meanwhile, found myself to be a more contemplative bent, a natural philosopher, scholar, and mentor to the young. Collectively, we were meant to be the world's moral guardians. Alas, our society was not as enduring as we. Having created machines to do their manual labor, mankind built more subtle engines to do their thinking as well. The times fell into lassitude and decay. We immortals, meanwhile, discovered that natural talents count for little without training and experience. Though we tried our best, we were ineffectual against the evils of the times. We saw the great nations of the world fragment and fall apart and could do nothing to prevent it. When civilization collapsed, The noble dog warrior and I gathered together all the books of philosophy, political science, and military strategy we could find and retired into the wilderness to think and to plan. We built a stone tower, and there I dwelt, reading and studying, while my friend farmed and hunted and protected me from the wandering bands of brigands, which were common in that benighted era. 3 times the tower fell into ruin from age, and 3 times we rebuilt it. There I studied until all the books had been read into dust. By then, I could have recreated them from memory. But what would have been the point of that? Those books had not prevented the disaster. Something greater was needed. So I entered into the second phase of my studies, contemplation. For centuries, I thought over the implications of what I had read, resolved its contradictions, discarded its errors, and synthesized what remained into a coherent unity. At last, I was, in theory, the perfect strategist, at which point I re-entered the world. In this third phase of my studies, I put my learning and theoretics into practice. I sought out small countries involved in particularly vicious and pointless wars and endeavored to put an end to conflict. Were theory all, this would have been the simplest matter imaginable, given my unequaled learning. In practice, making peace was difficult beyond imagining. My strategies were perfectly rational, but men are ruled by irrational desires. They lust for personal glory. They hate without reason. They feel little gratitude to those they owe most. Over the course of many years, I came to realize that the success of any nation ultimately depended on the character of its ruler. For while a great ruler with inadequate advisors cannot succeed, neither can a weak ruler with the best advisors in the world. At the end of our experiments, having proved to our own satisfaction that we could win any war, but lasting peace was a more difficult matter, we retired once again to a remote part of Mongolia, where I spent many decades meditating on how best to use what I had learned. At last, I was ready to enter into the final phase of my studies, healing the world. Lost my place? Long had I known that the healing must start with the restoration of China to her former greatness, for is not China the center of the earth? Create peace there, and it would radiate outward. So the noble dog warrior and I disguised ourselves as priests and went from country to country, observing the misery of their peoples and looking for a king who had the qualities of greatness within him. These qualities are, first of all, ambition. China must be reunited, and a king without fire in his soul is incapable of so great a deed. Second, firmness of action. As the ancient sage said, a war is not a tea party. Third, cunning. This goes without saying. Fourth, and most important, evasiveness. He who would be emperor will necessarily make enemies of all kinds, and these enemies will necessarily try to strike at him. The future emperor must therefore be a man whose true essence is not known, one whose physical self is elusive. In that way, the bullets and arrows of his enemies will always go astray. To state the obvious, that king is here, in this very room. We discovered that, in his compassion for the suffering of the people, he had already begun the noble work of reunification. History is hard, however, and fate uncertain. We knew he would need our advice and assistance, but he was, as I said, elusive. How then to bring ourselves to his attention? The noble dog warrior walked into brocade, presenting himself as a god. I played the part of a corpse. Together, we acted out a story in which a supernatural entity had brought a dead man to life. We knew it would be talked about everywhere. We knew, too, that the hidden king would send for us, and when he did, we would have the chance to tell our tale, and now I have. Dargar spread out his arm, the emperor that all of China is waiting for. The hidden king... The advisors wrestled with impatience. This is too unserious, one exclaimed. There were murmurs of agreement. The hidden king, however, rose to his feet. Is this a sign that I am chosen of heaven? Or do you seek to appeal to my pride by implying that I have a destiny? If the former, then this is an opportunity I must not throw away. Stranger tales than yours have turned out to be true. But if the latter, your flattery is pointless, for I already know that I have a destiny. He looked to his right and his left for confirmation. Sao, powerful locomotive, have I not often said so? Sao, white squall, you have heard it as well. A destiny such as mine cannot be hidden. It is like a great light, which though you pack it away in crates and wrap it about with canvas, shines through. Even this stranger can see that it burns within me, unless he is trying to deceive me. All that you say is true, O peerless monarch, Xiu, powerful locomotive, said. But the man who is dazzled by the light of the sun is not himself the sun. And he who can perceive greatness is not necessarily great in his own right. He cast a swift, shrewd glance Dargar's way. I believe that this stranger, this self-styled perfect strategist, should be tested. Well, said the Hidden King, what test shall we give him? There was an uncomfortable pause as his advisor looked to one another, waiting for someone else to speak. Then White Squall said, there is the question of the Prince of Southern Gate. If this Nonesuch is the prodigy he claims to be, let him solve that. If he cannot, let us kill him and move on. There's a murmur of agreement among her peers. That is an excellent test, the Hidden King said. An impossible task, one no man can be expected to perform. Explain the particulars, White Squall. The chief archaeologist nodded. Southern Gate, which I'm sure you know, lies along our northern border, is a minor kingdom of no great wealth. But to reach the land of mountain horses, which is our immediate objective, our armies must pass through Southern Gate. And so far, its king has refused to give us permission to do so. We could conquer that obstinate land, of course, but it would cost us men and months that we'd rather not expend. Are you following me so far? You are a model of concision and lucidity, Dargar said. At our request, the king of Southern Gate has sent a delegation headed by his eldest son to negotiate. The prince and his retinue are staying at an inn not far from here, as they have been for months. Our ambassadors make not the least progress with him. Nor would I, given in his place, the CEO said. Not only is it a matter of national pride, but of security as well. If three key cities were taken by our forces, which I am sure they could easily do, the entire kingdom would be held indefinitely. What possible ruler would allow that possibility? Ultimately, we will have no choice but to invade our northern neighbor. This is the Prince of Southern Gate understands as well as we do, and so he is willing to negotiate for as long as we are willing to allow our plans to be delayed. But no agreement can possibly be arrived at. He smiled coldly. It would take a perfect strategist to find a way out of this conundrum. Tomorrow, the Hidden King said, you'll go to this prince, speak with him, negotiate in my name. If he agrees to terms I consider reasonable, I will make you my advisors, second only to powerful locomotive and White Squall themselves. But if he does not, he shrugged, you along with your servant will die. In the morning, Darvin and Surplus were escorted to a meadow, where a city of brightly colored silk pavilions provided a neutral ground for the party from Southern Gate to meet with the Hidden King's ambassadors. They found White Squall beyond the tents, seated on a folding chair, sketching an antique building nestled in a grove of trees. Without looking up, she said, what you see before you is the inn where the Prince of Southern Gate is staying with his retinue. An unexpected touch of warmth entered her voice. It was built in the late Mao dynasty, when China was incomparably prosperous. Because utopians used laser saws, fast-setting liquid jade, sheet diamond windows, and other lost tools, materials, and techniques, the scrollwork and detailing of the building are incomparable. White Squall drew a final line and set aside the sketch pad. There, done. Dargar picked up the pad. Your rendering of the inn is as precise as an architect's blueprints, but it leaves out the romance of the place. I draw what I see, and when I look at the inn, I see only facts. We are well matched then, lady, for I see nothing but the romance. Tell me, if you will, of the Prince of Southern Gate. White Squall studied Dargar silently for a moment, as if she were looking for hidden motives behind his question. Then she said, Firstborn Splendor is a well-made gentleman, courteous and yet expressive of his views, a man of his word, and thus sparing of his promises, possessed of a good sense of humor, and yet utterly serious about matters of state, forgiving of the foibles of others when they do no harm, and yet uncompromising in his own virtue. In brief, he is the worst possible person to negotiate with. Many a tough nut has been opened by guile after brute force failed, Surplus observed. A servant hurried by with a tray of fresh-baked buns. He deftly snatched one and bit into it, adding, once he had swallowed, how much time do we have to prepare? The prince and his people will come in here in early afternoon, 3 hours, let us say. In the meantime, CO Perfectly Powerful Locomotive and I have been directed to give you anything you may need. Then we must begin preparations immediately. I shall require, ho, you! At Dargar's summons, a scurrying servant came to an abrupt stop. Is that wine you're carrying? Of what quality is it? Of the very finest, sir, for it is meant for the Prince of Southern Gate himself. Excellent, Darger said, taking the bottle from the startled man's hand. Where is capable servant? Here, sir, said that admirably unobtrusive fellow. Fetch me a gourd with a leather strap, such as travelers use to carry water on their voyage. Nothing fancy, mind you. Borrow it if you can, buy it if that's required, steal it if you absolutely must, but get it to me in 5 minutes. Sir, capable servant disappeared. It is too early for you to be drinking, White Squall said, reaching for the wine bottle, which was promptly whisked away from her. This wine is but one element in an intricate plan. Darger took White Squall's folding chair from the servant who would follow them, carrying it. Setting the chair in the shadow nearby tent, he sat. The noble dog warrior has a list of our other requirements. There is no need for list, Surplus said, for I have committed our needs to memory. Surplus could not possibly have done so, for Darger had come up with his scheme on the spot. Nevertheless, he held up a finger. First, a spool of crimson thread, along with 3 embroidery needles, a plate of water crackers, and 5 glass tumblers. He held up a second finger. Next, a giraffe, full grown, mind you, and in perfect health. It must be here before the prince arrives. A giraffe, White Squall said, in a tone such as would be employed only by a woman who is overcome with indignation. How am I supposed to find an African animal, full grown or not, on such short notice? Madam, Surplus said, the list is long, and enumerating it will take forever if you are going to raise objections whenever it strikes your fancy. I suggest that you jot down notes so we can discuss your quibbles after the first read-through and see if it is possible to make substitutions. Next, a lobster boat. White Squall put her hands on her hips. Now, that is simply impossible. We are 2,500 li from the ocean. Such negativity ill becomes you, great savage. Fourth, as the discussion grew more heated, Surplus could be infuriating when he put his mind to it. Darger accepted a gourd from capable servant and filled it with wine. Then, unobtrusively, he slipped away. It took Darger an hour to circle around the woods and so approach the country inn from the far side. The inn was handsomely situated near a small lake with a grove of flowering peach trees around the back. A man who could only be the innkeeper stood in the doorway, taking a break from his duties. Cheerily, Darger hailed him. Hello, my good fellow. Do you have a room free to rent to a wandering scholar who is for a brief time uncharacteristically affluent? Preferably one with a window looking out upon the lake, though from the exterior I judge that all your rooms are excellent. In this you are correct, sir. The elegance of our rooms is famous far and wide, and the landscaping such as to give pleasure from every aspect. But unfortunately, a delegation from Southern Gate is staying here. Would that they were not. By order of our own government, I must provide them food and lodging for free, and since all princes have enemies, I am not allowed to rent out the empty rooms lest they be taken by assassins. Oh, that is a great pity. Perhaps I could trouble you for a cup of water. Hospitality is my business, good scholar, and my nature as well. The hotelier went away and came back with a ceramic cup filled with cold spring water. Would you like me to fill your water gourd while I'm at it? Darger laughed. Impossible. This gourd is full of the finest wine from the hidden king's own cellars. It was a gift to him. It was a gift from him for some small services I was able to do. May I offer you some? Well, ordinarily at this time of day I would not, but how often does a man have the opportunity to taste the monarch's wine? The innkeeper stepped inside, returned with a second cup. Darger poured. Ah, how pleasant to be a king, if only for one sip. Allow me to top up your drink. This prince of yours, would he be the famous firstborn splendor? They say he is an exemplary ruler, but perhaps your experience has been different. Well, just as no man is a hero to his servants, so no prince is a hero to the man at whose inn he stays without paying. But he is a well-spoken young fellow who has no idea of the financial calamity he is visiting upon me and my family, so I bear him no personal ill will. To the prince, then. They clicked cups, and the innkeeper drank while Darger daintily absorbed a few drops of water. Allow me to refill that. You know, in my business, it pays to meet as many princes as possible. Do you suppose there's any way I could chance to encounter firstborn splendor? Well, at midday, he likes to walk alone in the peach orchard in order to collect his thoughts and cultivate serenity. I gather that the negotiations with the Hidden King's ambassadors have been very trying to his spirit. It's possible that if you promise to your cup is almost empty, sir. Let me refill it. For a time, they stood thus, chatting pleasantly. Then the innkeeper declared himself uncharacteristically woozy and went inside to lie down for a while. Dargar washed the two ceramic cups at a nearby spigot, strolled into the peach orchard, and chose a tree to sit beneath. There he waited. Prince Firstborn Splendor emerged from the inn, hands behind back, lost in thought. Slowly, he strolled among the peach trees, taking no particular notice of the nondescript scholar sitting with his back against the trunk of one until he was upon the man. Then he merely nodded slightly and passed on. The Hidden King, Dargar said no one in particular, is a homicidal maniac who must be killed if this land is ever to know peace. The prince whirled. Who is this who speaks such treasonous words about his own monarch? The king is mad. Dargar did not stand, but raised his eyes to meet the prince's. You have heard the rumors, and I, having stood in his presence, can assure you they are true. But as I am but a mendicant scholar of no family or reputation, that is nothing. CO Powerful Locomotive also knows this fact, and that is a great deal. Not that he would ever admit to such a thing, of course. Not to your face. He produced two wine cups and filled them from his gourd. Drink. The prince squatted upon his heels and accepted the cup. He did not raise it to his lips until Dargar had done so first, and then he only took the lightest sip. Is it him you represent? Perhaps, Dargar said. Then, addressing the sky, war is not a pleasant thing, but it is coming to your land. Our soldiers are ready, and the mountain passes are narrow. It would cost the Hidden King dearly to pass through Southern Gate without my leave. Indeed, only a madman would consider such an act. The prince said nothing. Still peering at the distant clouds, Dargar said, if only there were a way to turn this situation to your advantage. What do you mean? A traveler who is confronted by a pack of wolves does not raise his vision to consider the beauty of the mountains. He sees only the gleam of their teeth and eyes. So, too, all your thoughts are focused on what will happen when the abundant kingdom's armies enter Southern Gate. If they do so with your permission, it will be the easiest thing for them to, in passing, take your country and absorb it into the Hidden King's territories. If they are resisted, your cities will burn, your armies will be slaughtered, and your nation will fall anyway. So disastrous are your prospects that you cannot see that there is a third way. What is that? Hold your hands up before you, Prince. After the slight hesitation, Firstborn Splendor did so. See how clean they are. Spotless. Would you be willing to put up with a little dirt if it meant they would not be stained black with the blood of thousands of your subjects? Tense and wary, the Prince said, perhaps. Then listen to my proposal and say nothing until I am done speaking, for a conspiracy is like a machine made up of myriad moving parts whose purpose may not be clear until one considers them all together, and a plot which seems abominable midway through the telling is sometimes redeemed by the outcome. Pretend that I'm a storyteller. All I say is but a fanciful tale to idle away a pleasant hour. Now, let us imagine the possibility that rather than merely granting the Hidden King's armies permission to pass through your land, you were to propose an alliance with the Abundant Kingdom, one in which Southern Gate would be a subordinate territory. Sit down, sir! By beginning to listen to me, you made an implicit promise to hear me out. And, as I said, without your willing participation, this is but a tale. That's better. Remember, you have committed yourself to nothing as yet. I am a fellow of no importance. You have no reason to believe I have any influence with the Hidden King, or, more significantly, with any members of his court. It does not compromise you to listen. Or was I? Oh, yes. You were about to propose an alliance. Not only do you pledge the resources of your country, your intact, unplundered country, to the Hidden King's war, but you contribute military forces of your own to his armies, led by you personally and loyal to yourself alone. That automatically makes you a member of his court and one of his advisors. You will not be trusted, of course. Secretly, the hidden king will consider you a fool, but you will be useful to him and thus treated well. You will also have the opportunity to make friends among his advisors, and one whom I would most ardently advise you to befriend is Seo Powerful Locomotive. The prince's eyes were unreadable. His lips were white and thin. The king, as I've said before, is mad. However his war goes, in victory or defeat, there will inevitably come a time when his orders become so clearly disastrous that those closest to him must decide who is to survive, he or they. In that extremity, someone, and I cannot say whom, will see to it that the king is no more. Now, when a king dies, the matter of succession is a thorny one. If a general or even a CO were to assume his title, grave suspicion would rest upon him. But if there were a potential figurehead close at hand, someone of noble birth, yet not born in the country in question, well, he would be an obvious choice. For a year or three, provided that the figurehead king were cooperative, he would issue commands and edicts on the advice of his most trusted advisor. Then, when said advisor, a military man, no doubt, had consolidated his power and felt ready to take the throne to his own name, well, a second regicide would be an inauspicious beginning to the new king's reign. But suppose the figurehead king were a provincial from a small mountain kingdom of no great importance to anyone but himself. Imagine that his ambitions were modest. He might express a weariness with the duties of ruling a great nation and a yearning to retire to the land that gave him birth. In such a case, his successor would certainly feel grateful enough to present him with Southern Gate as his own possession, free and clear. Dargar ceased speaking and waited. All this in exchange for letting your nation's armies through, and for your promise to return to your own nation after 2 years' reign. Exactly who are you again? As far as you are concerned, I am a fellow of no importance, but a harsh truth from the mouth of a man you distrust is surely worth more than the most reassuring lies from the lips of those who would pretend to be your friends. Dargar stood, and Firstborn Splendor did likewise. Stooping to pick up the wine cups from the ground, Dargar said, "You and I have barely touched our wine. Are you willing to drink to our mutual understanding?" The prince's face was hard, but he nodded. They drained their cups. Then Firstborn Splendor squared his shoulders and turned back to the tavern. "I will have my scholars draw up a treaty immediately." When Dargar returned to the embassy tents with the treaty, Seo Powerful Locomotive and Sao White Squall were waiting to confront him. But when he presented the parchment, their indignation turned to astonishment. The CO snatched the document from his hands, read it through, scowling in disbelief. At times, his face looked inhuman. Then he handed it to White Squall, who was equally incredulous. "How did you ever convince the Prince of Southern Gate to see it our way?" she asked. "I lied to him," Dargar said. "Funny that never occurred to you to do the same." There you go. So when I was writing this, I found that the big problem with it was the characters, Dargar Circles, are so smart that I would set up a villain who's supposed to last for the rest of the book, and they would tame him or her in three chapters, and I'd have to bring in somebody new. Okay, I'm going to sign this in.
Thank you so much, Michael Swanwick. Thank you, Ravon Khanna. Thanks in advance to Matt Pressel and to Brooke Bollander. Mike, you're still on mic.
No equation. explain the division of the senses. No sound to reflect the radiance of time. In the beginning is dream, halls of disorder, where we are swept to encircle dawn, strapped in a low car, racing through silence, trumpeting bliss. You could kiss the world. Games cannot be yours. All the sights, the treasures of the eye. Does the divided soul remain the same? No equation to explain. Destiny's hand.
Well, I think it's about time. The way the corn's been growing for the last two or three generations.
Look at that herd of buffalo. They're ready.
Everything's living the Great Spirit's way, in harmony.
He'll be here soon.
The true white brother's coming home. Remember what the Great Spirit said? If we did what we were supposed to do and lived according to the plan, White Brother would finish his work in the East and come back to us. It'll be nice to have the family together again.
Buenos dias, amigo.
Hello, you must be the true White Brother.
Sure, you must be the Indians.
Yes.
Welcome home.
Welcome to New Spain. This is your new father, Father Corona.
Down on your knees now. Do you recognize what I'm holding over your heads, lads?
It's a cross, the symbol of the quartering of the universe into active and passive principles.
God have mercy on their heathen souls.
What the father means is, what is the cross made of? Gold. Have you got any?
No.
What about the seven cities of gold? Phoenix, Tucson, Las Vegas?
This is gold.
What's that?
Corn.
Hey, corn! Now we can make tortillas!
We've been waiting for this for hundreds of years.
So this is all you got?
Yes, but aren't you the true white brother who's supposed to come and live with us in peace?
Sure. Therefore, I claim this rich verdant of pasture land in the name of the Empire of Spain.
Hey, Capitano, the rain, she's a stop to fall, and the corn, she's all dead.
Shut up, Vespucci. I claim this stinking desert in the name of the Empire of Spain forever. Let's go.
God bless Vespucci land.
Oh, by the way, Domini, you're all Catholics now. God bless you.
Come on, and Father. Nobody in their right mind would live in this stinking desert.
Come on, Cisco.
Boy, I'm tired of pushing west. How long ago we leave Goshen?
About 2 hours ago. Ain't we ever gonna stop?
Not quite done, my boys. Wagon boss.
My fellow settlers. Hold it down. We stand here at the edge of civilization on the banks of the Mississippi River, looking west at our destiny. What may appear to the faint-hearted as a limitless expanse of God-forsaken wilderness
is
in reality a golden opportunity for humble, God-fearing people like ourselves and our families and our children and the generations are coming to carve a new life out of the American Indian.
Welcome, White Brother.
Engines! Pull the wagons up into a circle!
Why do you always do that?
We get better reception that way. Do you mind if I put this antenna up on yonder peak?
That's our sacred mountain.
This is our sacred antenna. It's shaped like a cross, made out of aluminum. Got any aluminum?
We've still got some corn left.
Hey, corn! Now we can make whiskey!
We've been waiting hundreds of years for this.
Just invented a Tom Collins.
Here, Engine, you want some fire water?
No. We were warned by our elders not to drink anything that would make us weak or silly.
Put it in their well.
That's not a well. It's the eye of the Holy Serpent Mound on which you're standing.
It's a butte.
No, it's a mound.
And right purty, too. Can you move it?
But why?
Railroad's coming through. Right now.
Hey, what are we stopping for?
We in Goshen yet?
Can't go no further. This here's engine territory.
Well, then, it's treaty time! My fellow Redskins, speaking for the Great White Father in Washington and all the American people, let me say we respect you, savages, for your native ability to instantly adapt and survive in whatever godforsaken wilderness we move you to. Out there. Sign here.
They did it!
No reason to complain. It's not so bad out there. We still have our people and our ceremonies and the sun, moon, and stars and the sand and the black stuff coming out of the ground.
Black stuff coming out of the ground?
Civilization! Ho!
Oh, I out here in the desert. No rain, no crops, no white brother.
All out for Fort Stinkin' Desert. Last Indian reservation for 2,000 miles. You got 15 minutes, folks. Get them while you can. Get the senator back in the bus.
Redskins, which way's Goshen?
Howdy there, colorful replica of America's past. When is the exciting in its primitive splendor snake dance going to take place?
It's usually in August, but with all our children off in Indian school, there's no one left to do the ceremonies.
Hiya, Pop.
I'm home.
Hello, Soaring Eagle. It's good to have you back from school.
Oh, come on. Call me Eddie. I'm an American now.
What have they been teaching you?
Just what we need for a better life. French horn, Italian, water polo?
Yes, at the Custer Memorial Indian School, Eddie's one of our prize students. We're giving him away next week.
Oh, my white brother.
Hey, man. Don't let him bring you down now. There's a lot of young people in this country just like myself who really know where the Indians at. And don't worry, soon we're all going to be out here on the reservation, living like Indians and dressing like Indians and doing all the simple, beautiful things that you Indians do. You got any peyote?
Hey, how much is that necklace you're wearing?
Do you know how to do the war dance?
Hold it. Smile.
Isn't it amazing how they survive on this stinking desert?
You got any scalps?
Hey, let me get a shot of you and your squad.
Hey, let's see the war dance.
Let's see the dance.
Let's see the dance.
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 Dance. Dance. Dance. Dance. Dance.
Okay, okay, folks. Fun's over. Back in the bus.
Where's little Billy Joe?
He's in that run-down outhouse over there, Mama.
That's our sun altar.
Well, Indian, just goes to show you there's an obvious need to conserve our priceless national heritage. The government is turning your home into a national monument.
It behooves me upon this historic occasion to dedicate the Stinking Desert National Historical Indian Monument and Cobalt Testing Range.
Civilization! Who?
It's about time. There's been no corn growing for the last few generations. The buffalo's gone. There's no one left to live in harmony.
I wonder where we went wrong.
Let's just keep to the life plan. Remember what the Great Spirit said. Follow the peaceful way. The true white brother is bound to come.
All right, Indians, get ready.
Winning of the West, the massacre, take four.
Well, let's go.
This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. You've been listening to two readings from just a couple of nights ago at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, Rajan Khanna and Michael Swanwick. Following that, some Patti Smith and Fire Sign Theater. Lister is on vacation, so stay tuned for another Hour of the Wolf over these same airwaves.
Adventures in time and space, told in future
tense. Dimension X.
The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Street and Smith, publishers of astounding science fiction, bring you Dimension X. By the year 1990, we should see many amazing technological advances. And yet, in many ways, life will be very much the same. A husband will stop off at a bar on his way home and perhaps unburden himself a little to a friendly bartender.
Another one, Mr. Smith?
What time is it, Sam?
Why, almost 10 o'clock, Mr. Smith.
One more.
Listen to them. The old songs are still the best, huh, Mr. Smith?
Yes, Sam. I remember singing that one back in 1974, just before I met my wife. Golden days, Sam.
Here's your beer, Mr. Smith.
Ah, thanks. Ah, that's good. Almost feels as if I can go home and face Nettie now.
Wife trouble, Mr. Smith?
Wife trouble, Sam.
Fight?
Oh, never. Nettie and I never fight. Nettie's too mad about me ever to fight with me. She adores me. Worships the ground I walk on.
Well, this is something new. I remember only last year you was complaining she was throwing things.
And times have changed. Only wish she was still throwing things. At least in those days I could walk out and slam the door with a clear conscience. Now she's so sweet and loving, I feel like a murderer every time I stop in for a beer on my way home.
Tough, Mr. Smith. Tough.
Ever hear the expression, love will fly if held too lightly? Love will die if held too tightly?
Can't say I ever did.
If only she'd relax a little bit. Bruise on my lip. She kisses me. For an hour every night when I come home.
Can you do anything for her?
I try. I remind her that she really wanted to marry Harvey Tubman. I remind her how we used to have those battles till the neighbors called the robot police. Nothing works. I'm gone for an hour. She cries.
Well, me, I ain't got that kind of trouble. I hang around too much, and Mabel calls me a loafer and turns me up.
That's a sad state. Can't figure him out. Well, I guess I'll go home and feed myself to the lioness. I tell you, Sam, when Nettie gets finished demonstrating how much she's missed me, I feel like a man who's been stuffed into an electronic washing machine with a dial set at rinse dry. How much do I owe you?
60 cents.
Well, if it isn't Henry Smith.
Brayling. I live and breathe Walter Brayling. What are you doing here?
Oh, having the night out.
Does Gloria know about this?
Things have changed, Henry.
I thought she kept you chained to the bedpost most of the time.
Not anymore, Henry. Not anymore.
Oh, you aren't divorced, are you?
Oh, no.
Gloria's home.
What'd you do, put a sleeping powder in her coffee?
Oh, goodness, no, Henry. That would be highly unethical.
I can't believe you just walked out on her.
10 years of marriage, Henry, and I never had a night to myself. But it'll be different from now on.
Oh?
By the way, Henry, what time is it?
10 o'clock.
Well, I guess I'd better be going.
Scared?
No, don't want to crowd my luck. Although, really, there's nothing to worry about.
I'd sure like to know how you do it, Walter.
Would you really?
Yes.
All right, Henry. Since you've always been a friend of mine, I'll let you in on it. Come on, my car is outside. I'll drive you home and let you see how it's done.
Well, that's nice of you, Walter.
Not at all, Henry. We fellows have to stick together. I don't suppose you know how Gloria and I came to be married in the first place, eh?
No, I don't.
Well, one evening, she threatened to tear off her clothing and call the police unless I married her.
No.
Oh, yes.
Well, that's a bit extreme, isn't it?
Well, Gloria was always a nervous girl.
I bet you've had a pretty wretched time of it.
Oh, yes, it didn't take long for me to become the laughingstock of the neighborhood. Hand-pecked railing, they used to call me. I know, but things are changing now. Here, you see this?
What's that?
A single ticket to Rio on the morning rocket. I have hotel reservations there for a month. A whole month, Henry, to have a fling.
Won't Gloria make trouble over that?
That's the amazing part of it, Henry. She won't even know I'm gone. I'll be back in a month, and no one the wiser. You don't believe me, do you?
Frankly, no. Just how are you going to swing it, Walter?
That's the secret, Henry. I tell you, it's the most wonderful thing ever invented. Worth every cent I paid for it.
What is
it? I'm going to show you. Here's my house. Notice the lights are all out. We'll wait up there on the front porch.
Walter, you haven't gone off your rocker, have you?
Shh. Now, I meow twice.
Meow! Meow!
Now, Henry, watch the window in my bedroom.
Well, it looks as if somebody... Hey, there's a man up there. He's looking out.
Good. He sees me. He'll be down directly.
Isn't it a bit embarrassing for you, Walter?
Oh, not at all. You'll find out. Here he comes. Hello, B2.
Oh, good evening, Mr. Brayling.
Close the door.
Either I'm going out of my mind or there are two of you. You never told me you had a twin brother.
I don't.
But if this fellow weren't in pajamas, I couldn't tell you apart.
That's the secret, Henry. Everything go all right, B2?
Oh, just fine, Mr. Brayling.
Uh-huh. I suppose my wife was in her usual good form this evening?
As a matter of fact, we spent the evening playing gin.
No screaming? No shouting accusation?
Oh, no, sir. It was a very quiet evening.
Well, this is even better than I thought.
Well, Marionettes Incorporated aims to satisfy, sir.
Did he say Marionettes Incorporated?
That's right, Henry. Look him over. Isn't he excellently fashioned? You wouldn't dream he was a robot, a marionette, eh?
Well, I can't believe it.
It's against the law, of course, to duplicate a human like this, but it's well worth the opportunity.
Well, I still don't believe it. You can't tell him from a human.
Only one way, Henry. Put your ear next to his chest. Listen. That's it.
Machinery. Walter, old man, how long's this been going on?
I've had him a month, Henry. I keep him in the cellar in my toolbox. Now, tonight I told Gloria I'd like to be excused for 5 minutes to run down to the cigar store. She agreed. I went down to the cellar, took out Brayling 2, sent him back upstairs to sit with my wife until I got home.
Miraculous. Of course, it doesn't seem quite ethical somehow.
Oh, nonsense. It's highly ethical. I've been home all evening. I shall be home with her for the next month. In the meantime, another gentleman named Walter Brayling will be in Rio having the time of his life.
Well, can he walk around without fuel for a month?
Oh, he refuels himself. And he's built to do everything. Eat, drink, sleep. You'll take good care of my wife, won't you, B2?
Oh, of course. Your wife is rather nice. I've grown quite fond of her.
You see?
Walter, old man... How long has this Marionettes Incorporated outfit been in business?
Secretly, for 2 years now. Why?
Well, I wonder, is there a possibility that I might get in touch with them?
You? But you love your Nettie.
Well, I know, but even so, just a little respite, a night or two once a month.
And she loves you dearly.
So much she can't barely leave me with for half an hour. You know that lately she's taken to calling me up at work 10 or 12 times a day to talk baby talk?
Your Nettie?
My Nettie. What do you say, old man? Favor to an old buddy? Fellow lodge member?
Well, I could put you in touch with the man who makes them. Of course, you'd be pledged to secrecy once you learned where he's located.
Oh, naturally.
Very well, Henry. Here's his card.
Marionettes Incorporated, W. Zig, proprietor and owner. New humanoid plastic 1990 model guaranteed against wear. Our motto, no strings attached. Address the Jumble Shop, 43 South Wesley Drive.
And Mr. Zig will take good care of you, Henry. He's a charming fellow, a real craftsman.
Wonderful. I'll see him first thing tomorrow. Well, I better be getting home now, though. Nettie's probably splitting a gasket.
See you around, old man, after I get back from Rio. And while I'm gone, you might drop around regularly, just as you always have. Treat Brayling, too, here as if he were me. Otherwise, Gloria might be suspicious.
Oh, I will. And, before I go, these marionettes are safe, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, tell them, B2. We're guaranteed.
Fine. Well, good night, Walter. Good night, B2.
Good night, Mr. Smith.
Good night, Henry.
Well, I'm glad someone else will have a chance at a little happiness and freedom. All right, Brayling 2. Back into the cellar box for you. Come on. Down the steps. That's it.
It's very damp down here, Mr. Brayling.
Damp plumbing. Well, here we are.
Brayling.
Yes.
Before you put me back into the toolbox, could we have a word?
Certainly, old man.
This toolbox.
What about it?
Well, I don't like it, Mr. Brayling.
Why not?
It's cramped.
Oh. Well, I'll try to fix up something more comfortable when I get back from Rio. All right, now. Before Glory gets worried back...
Marionettes are made to move, not to keep still. How would you like to lie in a stuffy old box most of the time?
I didn't realize you fellas were that sensitive.
Well, you wouldn't like it at all. I keep running. There's no way to shut me off. I have my feelings, you know.
Well, day after tomorrow, I'll be off to Rio, and you won't have to stay in the box for a whole month. Or you can move upstairs.
Yes, but when you get back from Rio, I'll go back in the box.
Mr. Zig didn't tell me at Marionettes Incorporated that it was possible to get a difficult specimen.
There's a lot he doesn't know about us. We're pretty new.
Now look here, B2. This has gone far enough.
I'll never get to Rio.
Now, come on now. Into the box.
And another thing.
Well?
Your wife.
What about my wife?
Well, I've grown quite fond of her.
Well, I'm glad you enjoy your employment. You'll have the whole month.
I'm afraid you don't quite understand, Brayling. I've fallen in love with her.
You what?
You just don't appreciate her. Maybe if you hadn't always acted so meek and apologetic about everything, she'd have a little more respect for you as a man.
Well, now, you aren't supposed to behave like this. You know you
think you... Well, anyway, I could be very happy if I were married to Gloria.
Aren't you forgetting? You're nothing but a big, overgrown puppet.
Careful, Brayling. I'm sensitive.
All right. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Now, look. You wouldn't mind waiting here a moment, would you? I have to go upstairs and make a phone call.
To whom?
Oh, nobody important. I have to call Henry Smith about something.
You're lying. You're going to call Marionettes Incorporated and tell Mr. Zig to come and get me.
Oh, no, really, I'm not. I was... B2, stay away.
Stand where you are, Brayling.
Now, B2, take your hand off my arm.
No, Brayling.
What are you going to do?
Nothing much. I'm just going to put you in the toolbox, lock it, and lose the key.
What?
And then I'll buy another ticket to Rio, and Gloria and I can have a wonderful vacation.
You're insane.
Am I?
Now, wait a minute. Hold on, B2. Now, don't be rash. Let's talk this over.
Goodbye, Brayling.
B2, stop it. Don't. Let go. Help.
Into the box, Brayling.
Help. Stop.
There.
Water.
Yes, Gloria?
Down there at this time of night?
Oh, nothing, lover. The pipes were knocking. I'm just making sure the boiler hasn't exploded. You go back to bed. I'll be up soon.
Well, hurry, won't you? We had such a nice evening. I'm lonesome for you.
Oh, you won't ever be lonesome again, darling. Never again.
Good morning, Nettie.
Oh, good morning, darling. How are you? Have a nice time last night? I missed you so.
Breakfast ready?
Aren't you going to kiss me good morning?
Oh, yes, I suppose so.
Oh, you're so wonderful, Henry. I guess I'm the luckiest person in the world. Here's your coffee. And how would you like your eggs?
Anyway, it's all.
Oh, but I want to please you.
Oh, Nettie, skip the eggs this morning.
Oh, but you have to eat to keep well, darling.
I'm very healthy. I have an early business appointment.
Oh?
It's a friend of Walter Brayling's. I met Walter last night, and he...
Yes?
I'd better be off. Now, Nettie, don't look as if I were on my way to Rio or something. I'm